this can be super conversational and
don't worry about going off message. Yeah, sounds great.
Okay. Yeah, it'll be fun. And we've had
and hopefully you can edit it a little bit.
Yeah, we will, and we'll try and keep it kind of tight.
You always make me sound good on paper.
Don't feel like it's different when you
This is Ask the Beacon, a podcast presented by and created for members of the Flathead Beacon Editors Club. I'm Andy Viano. A few weeks ago, I asked all of you to send over some questions you had for our staff, and you delivered. So today, we have our first answer.
Okay, cool. I'll just go ahead then if you're ready.
I'm ready.
Okay. Hi, my name is David Buckingham from Kalispell, Montana, and I would love to hear a podcast about invasive species in Montana, specifically in the Flathead and Glacier.
Thanks for the suggestion, David. And as you know, aquatic invasive species have been pretty top of mind here in northwest Montana in recent years because of the pervasiveness of quagga and zebra mussels around the country, and we will get back to those guys in a minute. But before we do, I brought in a couple experts to talk about the Flathead Basin's original aquatic party crashers.
I'm Tristan Scott, a senior writer for the Flathead Beacon. I cover Western politics and natural resources issues. So fisheries managers introduced lake trout and about 18 other non-native species to Flathead Lake and the surrounding basin in the late 19th century, early 20th century. And they did that to enhance the lake and its angling opportunities. So it was very focused on recreational opportunities. And I've heard fisheries managers in the region describe it as sort of a Johnny Appleseed approach, where they were just kind of throwing things out there to see what worked, and to see what took root. And when they introduced lake trout specifically and kokanee salmon, this would have been in the 1890s, and then lake trout in 1905, provided a great recreational opportunity for anglers, and the populations stayed pretty static through the years until the 1960s, and again in the 1980s, fisheries managers introduced mysis shrimp, which are, imagine sea monkeys. They're not microscopic, but tiny little invertebrates that they introduced into the Flathead River system in order to try and provide a protein source for kokanee salmon, which are kind of a landlocked salmon, a lot of fun to catch. And what happened instead was the mysis shrimp began to compete with the kokanee salmon's main food source, which is zooplankton, and the kokanee salmon population crashed. And then the other unforeseen consequence was the mysis shrimp provided this protein boost for lake trout, and that population soared. So kokanee salmon crashed, lake trout soared. They became sort of the top level predator and began to outcompete native species, 12 of which are native to Flathead Lake, including bull trout and West Slope cutthroat trout.
Yeah, hi, I'm Clint Mulfeld. I'm a research aquatic ecologist with the U.S. Geological Survey. I'm stationed in Glacier National Park, and I work for the Northern Rocky Mountain Science Center. And I'm also an associate professor at the University of Montana's Flathead Lake Biological Station. The population of lake trout exploded, back in the 80s. And across the board in the early 90s, we saw a dramatic decline in bull trout abundance throughout the upper Flathead system. And so bull trout complete their life history by migrating from spawning and rearing areas in the headwater streams. And they migrate down to Flathead Lake where they grow to maturity. So it's during that time that there's a lot of competitive interactions with lake trout, and being another top end predator, they're competing for food and space. And so we saw a dramatic decline in bull trout. And with that explosion in the lake, we saw the radiation of lake trout throughout the Flathead system. And so You think of lake trout as a fish that spends its entire life history in a lake. But actually we did some radio telemetry studies back in the 90s, early 2000s, and we found that these subadult lake trout actually made long distance migrations in this river system.
The lake trout's outward migration eventually took them throughout the Flathead's waterways, including to Glacier National Park, and they made their way to hard-to-reach corners of the park faster than scientists even thought.
So Quartz Lake is located on the western edge of Glacier National Park. If you are visiting Glacier National Park, drive through Polebridge, head up to Bowman Lake, there's a trail that takes you up to upper and lower Quartz Lakes. And so what happened with Quartz was they decided in the mid-2000s to build a fish barrier. They built this fish barrier thinking that Quartz Lake was not infested by lake trout. And after building this fish barrier, some anglers caught lake trout. And so they realized that there had been multi-generations of lake trout actually spawning in Quartz Lake.
Biologists were disappointed by the discovery of lake trout in Quartz Lake, but they also knew they had a unique opportunity to try and suppress a manageable population and with a fish barrier already in place to prevent new lake trout from arriving.
We knew it was a recently invaded system, and managers at the time wanted to take action to prevent the inevitable decline of bull trout and, you know, cascading effects across the entire food web. And so Glacier Park and USGS embarked on a cooperative project to try to suppress lake trout in the lake to save the native bull trout and the native fish assemblage in Quartz Lake. It's kind of one of the last of the best in the park. And so we started that work in 2009. And the idea was we were gonna over-exploit or suppress the population from both ends of the population. For one, we wanted to track the spawners to spawning grounds. So if we could reduce the number of adult spawners in the lake, we could reduce, obviously, their reproduction and recruitment to the population.
So you're tracking adult spawning lake trout to spawning beds. I think I heard you call them Judas fish.
Yeah, we call
giving up their own locations.
Exactly. Yeah, we call it the Judas fish approach because they basically lead us to their, you know, brothers and sisters where they're reproducing. And so, at the time, we thought, well, if they can lead us to these spawning areas, we can get there and maximize our removal efforts.
Quartz Lake is a beautiful sort of glacially carved little bathtub of a lake. And what fisheries managers decided to do, given that lake trout were fairly unestablished still, was attempt to what they call basically whack and stack these fish. They went through an environmental review, got the green light to helicopter a boat in, as well as other materials, and they started gill netting these fish.
And so our crews were literally, you know, we're 7 miles in the backcountry of Glacier Park at night, snow, rain, sleet, you name it. And we're actually out there tracking these fish to these spawning grounds. And we found over the course of the study that spawning was confined to these two avalanche chutes, these colluvial depositional areas. At the base of these avalanche chutes, these fish were coming in and spawning at night in great numbers. And so immediately we started netting those areas. And with success over time, we've been removing a substantial percentage of the adult spawners in the population. But because lake trout are so long-lived, we needed to also remove the juveniles that were already there before our efforts started, or that we were missed, that, you know, we're not going to get all of the adult spawners. So obviously there's some degree of reproduction and recruitment occurring. And so the idea was we wanted to hit the population from both ends. We want to remove the juveniles and the adults to try to collapse the population over a shorter period of time because they're such a long-lived fish. I mean, they can live up to 40 years.
For 5 years, from 2009 to 2014, Clint and his team continued to push forward before, to the delight of everyone, including, no doubt, the bull trout, they claimed victory.
For Quartz, it's, I think, one of the only success stories where we actually got there in the nick of time to reduce the lake trout population to the point that the bull trout, you know, remained abundant and widespread in the lake system. You know, if we had done nothing, the population would have exponentially grown and would have reached carrying capacity, maximum capacity for that lake as of now, as of last year, actually. And so we know, based on the information that we collected in the modeling, that we reduced the population to the point where they are likely not, the population isn't growing, and it's actually being reduced over time. Juvenile recruitment's been reduced, their survival and growth has been reduced, and the bull trout numbers have remained constant, if not increased, over time.
The win at Quartz Lake is just a small battle in the larger war, however. Estimates put the lake trout population in the Flathead Basin at 1.6 million, and some of Quartz Lake's unique characteristics, namely its fish barrier and spawning beds, make it more difficult, but not impossible, to translate some of the lessons learned to other water bodies.
So far, it hasn't been repeated exactly, but teams are doing similar projects in Glacier Park on Logging Lake, which had been essentially eradicated of bull trout and is home to a healthy lake trout population. They've been netting lake trout and Logging Lake and then actually moving bull trout from local fisheries hatcheries as well as from Logging Creek up to an upstream lake called Grace Lake and trying to reintroduce West Slope cutthroat and bull trout populations into that lake, which has a natural barrier constricting lake trout from colonizing it, and that's just a waterfall, so it's just a natural waterfall. So there are plenty of these lakes out there that would be ripe for this kind of reintroduction.
While Quartz Lake was a breakthrough, it was not the first time officials had been able to slow the spread of an invasive fish locally. And it was one of those old successes that led officials at Glacier National Park to recently float what sounds like an extremely dramatic option for repopulating native fish in some of the park's lakes.
The proposal in Glacier National Park is to use a chemical, a piscicide, called rotenone, to eradicate certain lakes in the Camas drainage on the western side of Glacier Park, to basically eliminate species that have colonized those lakes, and then using a brood stock from a fisheries hatchery in Creston of native West Slope cutthroat and bull trout fry, they would repopulate those lakes. And it sounds like a pretty dramatic solution, but it has worked in other cases, specifically the South Fork Flathead Lake drainage, which had a similar problem with invasive brook trout, rainbow trout, and hybridized rainbow West Slope cutthroat trout, where they did that in 21 lakes, restocked them, and it's been a success story. Controversial in the mid-2000s when it was first introduced, and over the course of the last 13 years, it's proven to be a real success story.
The South Fork Project also provided a blueprint for dealing with hybridization, basically the commingling of two related species of fish, a phenomenon that was slowly chipping away at the West Slope cutthroat trout population.
You mentioned the South Fork Lakes Project, and that was a system that had been extensively stocked in headwater lakes with rainbow trout, and there were genetic data that showed that those non-native genes were actually bleeding out downstream and corrupting those native gene pools that, again, have evolved over millennia. And because of the fitness consequences, and because we know that it's just a matter of time and hybridization is kind of a one-way street, that those populations in the South Fork, for example, that they were at high risk of hybridization. And so managers at the time, you know, they wanted to remove those sources from continued hybridization. And so as a last resort, they, you know, applied rotenone and Annamycin to those systems and eradicated those populations. And they restored them with using the nearest neighbor approach. So they restored them with these locally adapted neighboring populations to try to, you know, maintain that evolutionary history there. And that's been a very successful program. In fact, that's the largest conservation program that I'm aware of to restore cutthroat trout. And they've been highly successful in doing that and saving one of the last of the best. The South Fork, based on all the genetic surveys we've done throughout the species range, is the last of the best. It contains, you know, intact populations that are non-hybridized.
Last of the best, as Clint describes the South Fork, is also how he and others in the field describe Flathead Lake, which remains fairly pure despite a population of lake trout and mysis shrimp there. And that brings us back to the mussels, who can have catastrophic effects on the waters they infest, clogging hydroelectric systems and impacting almost anyone who uses those waters, and the financial costs of mitigating mussels could reach the billions of dollars. So I posed a question. If we can find ways to at least slow the progress of invasive fish, what does that information do to help us contend with the impending arrival of invasive mussels?
Yeah, that's an interesting question, because one invasive species is not like another invasive species. And so when you talk about managing, you know, introduced species like lake trout and rainbow trout, it's really different than how you would manage a mussel infestation. You wouldn't manage it. You would seek to control it and eradicate it. And there's so far been no evidence that that's possible. But in terms of, you know, again, an analog between invasive mussels and other invasive species, nobody wants invasive mussels. I mean, there's no recreational, you know, commercial fishing company that says invasive mussels will be good for our company. Whereas, you know, there are those people who want lake trout populations in Flathead Lake and the surrounding drainage.
The state of Montana and the tribes that protect local waterways have spent and continue to spend time, money, and energy on preventing invasive mussels from advancing over the Continental Divide, and so far, efforts have been successful. But in recent days, a boat was stopped at a check station near Anaconda with mussels on board, and most experts believe it's likely a matter of when, not if, invasive mussels make it through a checkpoint and into places like Flathead Lake. But that doesn't mean folks like Clint are going to stop trying or stop looking for ways to deal with the problem down the road.
It's an issue that's not going to go away anytime soon. It's only going to increase. So it's just really good to see our agencies, local, state, federal, coming together to work on this issue to try to prevent that. Because like you said, it has enormous ecological, social, and economic consequences. So, and often invasive species, once they become established, the impacts are irreversible. They're there for the long term. So by preventing their spread, we can try to maintain the ecological integrity of the system, which is really one of the last and the best.
That's where we'll leave the conversation today, but my many thanks to Tristan Scott and to Clint Mulfeld for sharing their expertise, and to Editors Club member David Buckingham for getting us onto this subject. There's so much more that we talked about that I did not get a chance to include, including a conversation about the impact climate change is having on our waterways and invasive species. And to learn more about all of this, you can, of course, read Tristan's coverage at flatheadbeacon.com or follow some of Clint's work in a number of places, and I'll have links to those places in the show notes. And as a reminder, you can send your question or topic suggestion to me anytime via the Editors Club Facebook page, by emailing Andy at flatheadbeacon.com, or by calling 406-257-9220. I'm Andy Viano. Thanks for listening, and I'll talk to you next time. Thank you.